Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy. I'm pleased to bring to you the fourth aliyah of the Parsha of Vayechi. Now that Yaakov is finished with his de facto firstborn Joseph, specifically giving him the double portion due to him as the de facto firstborn through his two sons, Yaakov calls for all of the other sons and will bless them or give them prophecies about what's to come individually. Vayikra Yaakov el banav vayiyomer he'asfu ve'agida lachem et asher yikra etchem ba'acharit yamim. And Jacob called to his sons and said, gather together and let me tell you what will occur to you all in the end of days. I think I need to talk about that expression, the end of days, acharit yamim. It is generally understood to mean or to indicate the days of Mashiach. And the Ramban, in fact, says that that is just so over here. Onkelos also reads many of these prophecies or statements to each of the sons in a messianic light, though not all of them. Of course, since much of these actual prophecies slash blessings slash predictions do not really read as end-of-day prophecies, Rashi says that Jacob meant to tell them exactly when Mashiach was coming, but the spirit of prophecy was removed from him so that he couldn't. But the truth is, if we look at many of these prophecies slash blessings, we'll notice that they actually occur, they do come to pass, following the Egyptian exodus, either in the desert or during the conquest period, starting from Joshua and then moving on to the first commonwealth, to the first kingdoms. And this really fits with what I heard from Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, regarding the end of the Egyptian exile, which was that Moshe Rabbeinu really should have been the Melech HaMashiach, and that the exile in Egypt was supposed to be the one and only exile after which the Jews would go into their land and stay there forever and ever and ever. So, Acharit HaYamim does in fact mean the end of these days, but the end of the days specifically of the darkness and exile of the Egyptian exile when redemption will come after them, and we'll see what will happen after once that messianic time will come. The fact that we had a second exile in Babel, that the first commonwealth did not last, and then the second commonwealth of the second temple also did not last, and now we're in a third exile, that's besides the point. The point is that after the Egyptian exile, that was a real exile, and what was to come afterwards was an redemption, a messianic redemption. The fact that it didn't actually turn into a messianic redemption didn't mean that that's not the way that Yaakov saw it. So Yaakov's vision of the end of days is as he sees it. And that's why it refers to events that really fall in Yoshua's conquest of the land and what takes place afterwards. Whether these prophecies will also recur in the next redemption, we'll just have to wait around and see. Hikavtsu v'shimu b'nei Yaakov v'shimu el Yisrael avichem. Gather together and listen, children of Jacob, listen to Israel your father. Note that the form that we're reading here is that of biblical poetry, which can usually be identified by a structure called parallelism, wherein a single idea is stated both in the first half of a poetic line and then it's repeated, usually with some variations, in the second half. The significance of these variations, whether they're completely different or whether they're the same idea and different, expressed in different ways, that's beyond the scope of the shiur. However, note that here there is an important variation. Yaakov is the name in the first half and Israel is the name in the second. So we get up to Yaakov's first blessing slash prophecy slash guidance slash command or whatever it really is, because it's a little different for each son. And number one son in Jacob's list is, of course, Reuven, who is his firstborn, or was his firstborn before he lost those rights. And we'll see what that means in a second. Reuven b'choriata kochi b'reshit oni yeter se'et v'yeter az. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my strength, and my first child. Oni can mean strength, or child, or even a financial treasure. Higher in elevation, and higher in power. The idea is that Reuben should have had the power and the property that was due to the firstborn. However, Pachas kamayim al totar, ki alita mishkevei avicha, az chilalta yitzui Allah. Unrestrained like water, so you will not be higher, because you mounted the bed of your father, then you profaned my bed, he mounted it. As I've mentioned before, it states in Chronicles chapter 5 that Reuben was the Bechor, he was the firstborn. But when he messed up with this whole bed incident, that firstborn status was stripped from Reuben and given to Joseph, who was a firstborn, albeit from Rachel. Now, let's talk a little bit about Reuben's sin, which is only hinted at here. So Rashi over there in chapter 35, where the sin is spelled out, cites the Midrash that Reuben did not sleep with Bilhah. All he did was he pulled Bilhah's bed out of Yaakov's tent. He was very insulted that after Rachel's death, Yaakov did not sleep, go back to sleeping with his mother on a regular basis. And that, the justification for coming up with a much lighter crime than the one that is specifically mentioned there, there is a justification to that, because if Reuben's sin is really as it was described, if he's some kind of, you know, deviant who sleeps with his mother, with his father's wife, even though it's not his mother, then the question is, why would Reuben really have remained in the 12 tribes? Why would he be worthy of being a tribal part of Israel? However, the plain sense, as we can see that's stated in chapter 35, is it says that Reuben in fact slept with Bilhah. I also want to mention at this time that I've talked about Reuben before in Parshat Miketz, that he's a very self-centered personality. When he finds Joseph is missing from the pit where they tossed him, he yells, Anna, Ani, Anna, Ba, which really means, Ani, 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 me, what will become of me? He's not worried about what happened to Joseph, he's worried about what effect it will have on himself. And if we put all that together and we look at one more key, we find the way to unlock the meaning of Reuben's, exactly what Reuben did and why. In chapter 25, it doesn't say that he slept with Bilhah. It says he slept with Bilhah the Pilegesh, the concubine of his father. Now, Bilhah was not a Pilegesh. That term is never used by her. It says she was an Isha, his wife. The Torah says so specifically. So why would the Torah use the unusual word Pilegesh? Well, if we look at everywhere in the Tanakh where someone sleeps with a Pilegesh, it happens by Avner, who was the general of Shaul after his death, Avshalom, who was the second born son of David, Adoniel, the fourth born son of David, who tried to sleep with a Pilegesh of David. It's never about sex. It's about a power grab. Because when one sleeps with the king's Pilegesh, one is essentially saying, I am inheriting the king's property. I am the next king. So Reuben didn't sleep with Bilhah out of sexual desire. It calls her Pilegesh to point out that he's sleeping with her because he wants to seal up the deal that he is going to be the next king. He is going to inherit from Jacob. Now, why would he have to seal that deal? He already is the firstborn. He should get that. But it's his insecurity, his self-centeredness, which causes him to force an issue which he shouldn't have to force. And ironically, that very act shows how unprepared and incapable and inappropriate it is that he should be the king. So what we have here is not so much a prophecy or even a blessing, but a public statement that Reuben is not in the position to take on political responsibility that is needed for the king. And it's important that Yaakov make this statement. It's important to let the tribe of Reuben know that it's out of the running for kingship. In fact, the tribe will actually make a try at being a ruler during the Korach rebellion under a guy named On ben Felet. But the movement will fail because Jacob has here clearly stated that Reuben has no claim to be be on the throne based on their tribal character, which starts with their ancestor Reuben himself. Now we get to Shimon and Levi. Now, had you read the Shimon and Levi's conversation with Yaakov following the Dinah Shechem story, where they go and they really wipe out Shechem because Shechem raped Dinah, and they wiped out all the men that they had made a covenant with, you would have assumed that the brothers get the last word there, which they do, and therefore the Torah is sort of justifying their devious abrogation of the treaty and the destruction of Shechem when they say, will our sister be turned into a harlot? And since Yaakov doesn't answer that, one gets the feeling that they get the last word, so the Torah sort of comes out on their side. That is not the case, however, and one can see from here that Yaakov gets the last word, and he gets quite a harsh word as well. Shimon v'Levi achim klei chamas mcherotehem. Shimon and Levi are brothers, meaning they are of the same personality. Their weapons are tools of violence. Jacob clearly equates their actions, their slaughter of Shechem, of the people of Shechem, with violent and terrible behavior. And let's read on before we examine this point. Bisodam al tavon nafshi bekalam al techad kivodi kivyapam haragu ish uvir tzonam ikerut shor. In their company, let me not come. In their group, let my honor not be counted. Because their anger, in their anger, they killed a man, and in their plotting, they uprooted an ox. The word sowed here does not mean secret, bisodam, does not mean in their secret, but in their group, in their clique, which is, of course, where secrets are shared. And in my opinion, we find out that these two are actually the ones who instigated the other brothers to kill Joseph. Now, back in chapter 37, it says one said to the other, and the Midrash reads into the text that it was Shimon and Levi. However, to my mind here, it's actually stated clearly in the Midrash is playing off that. The ish that they killed is no doubt talking about Shechem. But who is the ox who is uprooted? Who is Birt Sonam Ikaru Shor? So the ox and the calf, first of all, they're symbols of Joseph, meaning that Jacob is essentially accusing them, although indirectly, of causing Joseph to be nearly killed and sold. And Onkelos makes it more obvious that this is true by changing the word shore here to shore, which is a word used in Yosef's blessing slash prophecy, as we'll see later on. Anyway, Yaakov continues, Arur apam ki az v'evratam ki kashata, their anger is cursed because it is too strong, and their rage is cursed because it is too harsh. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them through Israel. I learned the following from my teacher, Rabbi Menachem Liutag, which is, you know, the incredible point that he taught me, which is that this is exactly what happened to the two tribes when Joshua entered and conquered the land of Israel. Neither Shimon nor Levi ever receive a portion of the land of Israel. Shimon winds up being absorbed into Judah's territories. He never receives land of his own. He may get it later on after the split of the kingdom, but it's not clear that that's happened. And Levi, who is treated a little bit better because he had a nice showing in the desert when he did Moses' holy work, a very difficult work at that. But the bottom line is, Levi never gets property either. He lives in these cities, really kind of imprisonment cities. Not that they're in prisons, but they're sort of like they are kind of prisoner cities for anybody who kills accidentally, runs away to these cities. And they were wanderers. They really attached themselves in, they had no land. They lived in these cities, or they worked for individuals and got paid miser, Levi for the work that they did. And what Rabbi Liebtech explained to me is the following, that the following is Jacob's position. Protecting the honor of one sister is all very well and good. But Jacob at that time was not on a family personal mission. He was on a national geopolitical mission. His responsibility, I mean, he had a responsibility to his family, but his primary responsibility as a general of a future, as a leader of a future budding nation, is to build the land, to conquer it where he must, but to be able to make treaties where he could. Geopolitics, real politics, does not need hotheads. It requires a calm and steady hand, a person who could sort of put together personal needs, no matter how important those personal needs are, for the greater good of the people. Hotheadedness leads only to war. So no matter how honorable Shimon and Levi's actions were on a personal family level, those actions could not have been more destructive and reprehensible on a national or a nation-building level. Once Israel is pegged as treaty breakers and murderers of those who they made a treaty with, who will ever deal with them again? And if nobody will ever deal with them again, and everybody will always be their enemy around, how viable is the ability to create that nation? So Jacob essentially is saying is, your anger is too strong for my nation to exist securely. So I will make sure that you are scattered and landless. You could, of course, live in the country, be part of the people. But I will make sure that you are not in the position to wreak geopolitical havoc again. You do not deserve land in the future state of Israel. On to the next son, who is Judah. Yehuda, ata yoducha achecha, yadcha ba'orif oivecha, yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha. Judah, your brothers will praise you, your hands will be on the necks of your enemies, and your father's children will bow to you. In essence, Jacob is saying that Judah will be the head of state. the nation's king, and that everyone will recognize and praise it as Judah suppresses all enemies of all those who come in enmity to the nation. And it's possible that the reference to the sons of your fathers, which is awkward, why not just say brothers, is to make sure that Joseph understands that he too is included under the state rulership of Judah. If he just said your brothers will bow down to you, so he might not, people might think that doesn't include half-brothers like Joseph. Gur Aryeh Yehuda Miteref Bni Alita Kara Ravatz Aryeh Uchlavi mi yikimenu. Judah is a young lion. You rose up from the kill. You crouched like a lion, and like a lion or like a panther or whatever it is. I'm not sure what the difference is between an Aryeh and a Lavi. Who can make him get up? Now, I translated this as you rose up from the kill, and that is reading it as a metaphor to the Joseph incident, meaning rather than you pouncing for the kill and wanting him dead like a lot of the other brothers, like Shimon and Levi, you extricated yourself by that, by suggesting that they just sell Joseph, which of course is bad, but it's not the ultimate bad of murder. Ibn Ezra does point out that the grammar doesn't really fit this read of the text, and that the real read is you rose up for the kill, and then crouched all over the kill and cannot be moved away from it. So if we want to read this as a metaphor, perhaps it is speaking to Judah's steadfastness in protecting Binyamin in and out of Egypt, not backing down neither to Jacob nor to Yosef, who they didn't know was Yosef at the time, even when the threat was great. Or perhaps it just means that in the future, when the Judaic monarchy under David decides to hunt its prey, it will not be deterred until the meal is done, so to speak, although I seem to have substated one metaphor for another metaphor. Lo yasur shevet mi Huda umechokek mi ben raglav. A staff will never be removed from Judah, nor will the chisel be removed from between his legs. The chisel, which is really a quill, is used to etch cuneiform writing. At that time, when really Yaakov was going down to Egypt, the standard writing, international writing, was written in cuneiform. That's where edicts were written. And it was essentially this kind of pen or chisel which was pushed into the text, into clay, and then baked solid after whatever was written was written. So therefore, the pen is a sign of authority, one who makes laws and sets them into stone. And the intent is that while kingdom and dynasties may come and go, Judah's will last forever and ever. The verse continues, Ad ki avo Shiloh velo yikat amim, up until he comes to Shiloh, or until Shiloh comes, and to him all the nations will obey. That is, they'll all obey him. There are a lot of possibilities on all of this, including the meaning of Shiloh. But I'm going to stick with the idea that this is a prophecy of events that take place in the city of Shiloh, which is about, half an hour drive north of Jerusalem. But even there, even if we say that it's Shiloh, it is not clear if the sense is that the Judean kingship will never be interrupted, starting with the setting, the word Ba'akim mean to set, or destruction of Shiloh, which was the capital of Israel from the time of Joshua until its destruction by the Plishtim in the time of Eli and Shmuel, which means Yehuda's not going to be a big player until Shiloh gets destroyed, and then once Shiloh gets destroyed, Yehuda's going to rise on the scene, and that will be the permanent kingship of Israel, rather than having the leader bounce around from tribe to tribe. Or maybe it means that some event will take place in Shiloh to interrupt the Judean kingship, as the Rashbam claims. The Rashbam equates Shiloh with Beit El and Shomron and the splitting of the kingdom into two under Yeravam ben Nevat after Shlomo dies. Personally, I like the first one, that once the Davidic king rises as the tribal ruler for all of the tribes as a united government, and that follows the destruction of Shiloh, then that is the permanent. That is, once the Davidic king, once the Judean king gets the nod, that becomes a permanent kind of thing. As I said, there are other possible meanings, prophetic messianic poetry is very hard to pin down, so I'll offer that meaning and feel free to examine some others. Osrei la gefeni ro velasho rekam bini atono, Kibes bayayin levusho uvdam anavim suto. His donkey will be tied to the vine, and his donkey's kid to a rich vine or to a or kind of a lush vine. He washes his clothes in wine and his cloak in the juices of grapes. This seems to be a reference to the vineyards that grow richly in the Judean mountains even to this day. That is a very simple meaning. It's saying that his property will be so wealthy that, be so many vines around that you could actually afford to tie your donkeys to them. The doubling of the language is classic, and it's not really clear if there's a difference between Geffen and Shoreka, between the donkey and then the donkey's son, between Levush, which means clothes, and Suto, which seems to be an abbreviation of Kisuto, which means a cloak. On the other hand, it could be that each of these variants may be prophesizing something distinct. Onkelos, the Aramaic translation, makes it very clear that this is all referring to a future Messianic king of Israel, and that his clothes will be of a certain color, the royal purple, and that's what the juices of grapes or the blood of grapes means, and it's referring to a temple in Jerusalem, and certainly all that is quite possible. His eyes will be reddened from wine, which means he'll be drinking a lot of it. But actually, I kind of like the translation, it will be redder than wine, literally, it will be rich. And his teeth either will be white from milk or be whiter than milk. Now, this is clearly a metaphor, because obviously they're not trying to compliment him because he drinks a lot of milk and wine, unless it's just trying to say that he's rich. But one sense is a metaphor here. Perhaps it's referring to the mighty cliffs and beautiful spires of the Judean mountains. Perhaps it's referring to the Temple Mount, and the wine refers to the sacrifices done there, and chalav may be a play on chalav, the fats of these sacrifices. It's really hard to say. Anyway, on to the next son. Zebulun, I should say that it's clear that Yehuda is getting... There are two sons that really get the biggest portion of the blessings. One is Yehuda, and one is Yosef, and that's because those are the two leaders of the Jewish people, so they really get a lot of time spent on them. Anyway, as I said, on to the next son. Zebulun l'chof yamim yishkon v'hu l'chof oniyot v'yar chato al tzidon. Oh, Zebulun, he will dwell on the seashore, even to the bays of the ships, meaning he will deal in the sea trade, and his extent will reach Sidon. Sidon is a city-state located in Lebanon of today. Now, the weird thing is that it was really Asher that would get the land that's being described here. Asher lived on, like, Akko and on the Mediterranean Sea, and his territory extended all the way up to Sidon, to Zidon, in Lebanon. So it could be that things simply changed from Yaakov's prophecy for some reason. Maybe it was the Zebulun tribe that we have that was really defined by Joshua is sort of stuck in between Asher, which is on the coast, and Yisachar, which is to the east of it, which is sort of abuts the Jordan Sea and the lower part of the Yam Kinneret. Perhaps there was a symbiotic relationship that formed between Yisachar and Zebulun in the desert, and that required that their territories be adjacent, but it strikes me a little bit strange that the blessing seems more appropriate for Asher than it does for Zebulun, and Zebulun, in fact, never got property on the coast. But for all we know, Zebulun actually, maybe it didn't live on the coast, but it built ships. Hard to say. And here's now Yisachar's blessing. Yisachar chamor garem roveitz ben hamishpatayim. Yisachar is like a strong-boned donkey who lays down amidst the sheep corrals, which means it wanders in the fields, and it's guided in between the corrals that belong to private land, and it sort of lies down on the public land in between those private lands. And he sees how good the rest is, that is rest as in resting on the ground, and how pleasant the land is, so he bends his shoulder to carry burdens and becomes a tax laborer. Rashi, following Midrashim, says that all this is a metaphor for learning Torah, different parts of Torah, and that Yisachar was excellent at it, and their job was to support Zebulun. But the plain sense is that whereas Zebulun will seek the fortune in international trade on the sea, on the oceans, Yisachar will trade by land routes, like a trucker of today, until they become essentially the de facto bearers of burden, the official teamsters for international land trade. Ibn Ezra actually comes up with another idea that says they weren't warriors, they were traders, so therefore to avoid the taxes for war, that is, national drafts, they would provide services instead. And now on to Dan, who is the first of the the handmaiden tribe. She is the eldest of the, she's Bilhah's child, the eldest of the four handmaiden children. Dan Yadin Amo Ke'achad Shevte Yisrael. Midrashic literature, followed by most commentaries and Unkelos, says that all of what's going on here in Dan in the next few verses is referring to the future leader Shimshon, who was from Dan, and the famous stories of Shimshon, which could be found in the book of Judges. Rashbam doesn't like this at all, and says that this refers to the tribe of Dan being a rear guard for the other tribes as they travel through the desert. Dan was the head of one of the four sections. He was the north of the Mishkan, and he really brought up the rear, which is a dangerous position in war. And also a very important one, because you have to make sure you didn't get attacked from behind. The little translation is that Dan will judge its nation, as in the rest of Israel, just like one of the tribes of Israel. And I think maybe just in a simple sense, the point may be that Jacob is making is that Dan, as a representative of all the handmaiden tribes from Bilhah and Zilpah, that is Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, but Dan is their representative because he's the oldest. I think Jacob may be making a point that the other tribes may have been saying, well, you know, we could be the rulers, we could have the tribal leaders, but Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, they're just the handmaiden children. So therefore they're lower in status and they don't have the ability to rule over the other Rachel and Leah born tribes. So what Jacob is saying is no, Dan will judge its nation just like one of the tribes of Israel, which means they have an equal portion of the land, and then you can't treat them as second class citizens, neither in terms of citizenship and neither in terms of listening to their leaders should they come onto the stage. And with Shimshon, that point is proven to some extent. Yehi Dan nachash ale derech shvifon ale orach anoshech ikvei sus vayipol rochvo Achor. Dan will be the snake on the road, a viper in the path who bites the heel of the horse, and then its rider falls down backwards. And this, of course, is more in line with Rashbam's idea of Dan as the rear guard that attacks in surprise. That is when the enemy thinks that it's, you know, encountered Israel and all Israel's tribes have been deployed, pops up Dan from hiding and attacks them from behind. Most commentaries, by the way, agree that the next line concludes Dan's blessing in privacy. The next line is the last line of this aliyah. But it's not the last blessing. We have more blessings, more children to come, or more prophecies for these children. But the line goes, the pasuk says, Lishuatcha kivit Yashem, which is very strange because it seems like all of a sudden Yaakov's talking again, to your salvation, I wait or I hope for your salvation, O Lord. So the question is, who's talking here? Many commentators see this as a reference from Shimshon, and it's talking about after his eyes were plucked out when Shimshon begs for salvation from God. If you only let me do this one last thing, God, and I could take vengeance upon my enemy. Now, whether it's putting words or prophesizing words similar to the ones Shimshon will say, or whether Jacob is saying, please, you know, I wait for your salvation because when this happens to Shimshon, we're going to be in trouble if Shimshon doesn't win. It also fits in nicely if it's a rear guard issue, like Rashbam says, which means, I know, Jacob says, you know, he puts words into the mouth and says, I know that the work of Dan in being the rear guard, the one who always attacks the enemy and surprises, is a very dangerous business. It's a risky move. It's like a Hail Mary or a flea flicker in football. And when you get to this point, you really need to be ready to make a lot of, kind of a direct prayer for salvation, because it's a very dangerous game. And that's the end of the Saliyah. We will continue with more children's blessings or prophecies in the next Aliyah.